All right, I'd like to welcome you, including all these interesting characters we have never had here before. Don't recognize them anyway. I'm Dan Proud. I'm a member of the congregation here, and I'll be presiding over the service today. Sometimes we have our minister, Sandy Ingham, do this. So if you're a visitor today, we have a variety of presentations, programs on Sundays, and so if this is not necessarily typical. Prairie aspires to be an open-hearted, open-minded community, and we're as opposed to an exclusive congregation, we're an inclusive congregation, and we welcome people of any ethnic or religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, religious background, family structure, we welcome you. All right, and now we'll have opening words by Robin Proud.
From Mary Shelley, "No man chooses evil because it is evil. He only mistakes it for happiness, the good he seeks." For our chalice lighting, I said to Dan, someone should say something, and I guess it's me. I chose this lighting, it happens to be from the Passover Haggadah, and I had this whole program put together a couple months ago when I did it in Sauk City, but it reminded me that our religious communities continue to be attacked, this terrible shooting at a synagogue, and in a string, we had the Sikh temple here in Wisconsin, we've had violence in a number of places, so just to honor those people who are in a community like this, when something happened, we don't post guards here and carry guns inside here. And, you know, we never thought that something like this could happen, and it has in some places. May the light we now kindle inspire us to use our powers to heal and not to harm, to help and not to hinder, to bless and not to curse, to serve you, Spirit of Freedom.
Now it's my particular pleasure to introduce the speaker. We've done this many times. I'm not sure there's too much more I can say about my wife, Robin, except that now she's retired, which she's delighted. So we're having a new phase of our life, and so far we've been accompanying ourselves all over the region, I guess. I don't know if I'm her chauffeur or what that is, but it's been a fun time for us, and she is giving talks frequently, so this is one of the joys of her life. So enjoy yourself.
Thank you. It was a dark and stormy night. In fact, there were a succession of dark and stormy nights in 1816 because the volcano Krakatoa had exploded some months before, and this was known as the year without a summer. The ash changed the climate. Unfortunately, this was when Mary Shelley and her companions were trying to enjoy the summer in Lake Geneva. And it was because of this that she wrote this classic horror story. So today I'll tell you a bit about Mary Shelley's background, a little bit about Frankenstein Beyond the Myths, and how it's relevant today as we contemplate new frontiers of science. Mary was the child of celebrity parents. Her mother, Mary Wollstonecraft, was one of the most famous and infamous women of her time. She was self-educated, as all women needed to be in the 18th century. She celebrated the French Revolution and its rights of man, and then she turned around and wrote a book called A Vindication of the Rights of Woman in 1792. Influenced by Rousseau, she stated that both men and women are born as a blank slate, and any deficiencies in women's abilities come from unequal education. She said women were trained to be weak and silly, but there was no reason why the sexes couldn't be equal. Mary Wollstonecraft had lived out this belief. She supported herself and her sisters with her writing. She had an illegitimate child with an American, Gilbert Imlay, and when he deserted her, she raised the child on her own. She had suggested moving in with him and his wife, but that didn't go. Now she, we have under our famous Unitarians, we do have her. We're not sure about Mary Shelley because of their later atheism. Mary Wollstonecraft returned to England, and where she was reintroduced to a man named William Godwin. They had met once years before, but neither had been impressed with the other. But now there was respect and attraction. Godwin was as much a radical as Mary Wollstonecraft. He was an atheist, and he opposed marriage as a convention harmful to both sexes. Ironically, when they became intimate and Mary found herself pregnant, they both agreed they should marry in order to protect the child. Mary had seen how difficult it was to raise an illegitimate daughter, so she already had a three-year-old. Godwin was mocked in the press for turning against his principles, but he was surprised at how happy he was with domestic life. He was fond of his stepdaughter, Fanny, who was three, and although he still spent hours away from the house writing, he enjoyed evenings at home reading and talking philosophy with his new wife. That didn't last. On August 30th, 1797, after a long labor with the help of a midwife, a baby girl was born, named Mary after her mother. But when the mother was not able to deliver the placenta, Godwin sent for a doctor. The doctor ripped out the placenta with no anesthetic, which caused Mary extreme pain, but what was worse, he introduced an infection which would kill her. Doctors at the time saw no reason to wash their hands and came to a pregnant woman from another or from a diseased person or even from a corpse. Then the diagnosis would be childbed fever, which caused the women to die within a few days. After that, it seemed to blame the women. Mary Wollstonecraft died after considerable suffering when Mary was 10 days old, the baby Mary. Now, we don't want to overdo psychological analysis of authors, but it seems to me not a coincidence that little Mary, abandoned by the one who gave her life, would grow up to write a story where the creator of a life abandons the creature to fend for itself. And also where the creature feels he doesn't belong anywhere. Godwin was devastated and raised his small daughter with a portrait of her mother prominently displayed. They made regular visits to the tombstone where young Mary learned her letters by tracing the engraving of her mother's name. A bit gothic. Mary was very attached to her father, but he was a man of philosophy, not given to physical displays. He realized he needed a wife to raise his two daughters. Within a few years, he married his new next-door neighbor, Mary Jane Claremont. She claimed to be a widow, but actually she had never been married, and her two children each had different fathers. Maybe this made her more accepting of Godwin's unusual situation. Mary was four when she was presented with a new mama, and she never accepted this interloper. The new stepmother felt Godwin was spoiling Mary, and she treated her more harshly than the docile Fanny, the three-year-old, or her own daughter, Jane, who came into the household. When Mary later wrote about her childhood, she spoke of her happiness in places away from home, Ramsgate by the sea, and Scotland, where she stayed with family friends. While the teenage Mary was away in Scotland, a young man introduced himself to Godwin as an admirer of his writings. This young man, Percy Bysshe Shelley, was 21. He was married to a 19-year-old named Harriet. He had eloped with her to help her escape a stifling home, but he agreed with Godwin that marriage was an unfair type of bondage for both parties. He had left Harriet with a small child, and shortly after she discovered she was pregnant again. But Shelley saw himself as too large for a conventional life, such as marriage, supporting your family, paying your bills. He despised the bourgeois, and in a way it reminds me of some people I knew in the 1960s. When 16-year-old Mary returned from her Scottish visit, she met the new family friend. Everyone agreed that Shelley was an archetypal romantic hero with his fine features and tousled locks. Now, I just saw the film that was made of Mary Shelley last year, and while some of the facts were changed, some to improve the story and some, it seemed to me, at random, I thought the tone seemed good. There, the fellow who played Shelley, I don't know the actor, he looked kind of like a young Bob Dylan, so he had some attraction. Mary Godwin, so Shelley was quite attractive, of course. Mary Godwin was not only beautiful, but the descendant of the two freethinkers that Shelley idolized. Both Percy and Mary admired how her mother had despised convention, and they saw no reason why they should be bound by narrow ideas. They read aloud to each other from Mary Wollstonecraft's books at the cemetery. And after a few weeks, young Mary Godwin stood in front of her mother's headstone and threw herself into Percy's arms. This was the grand romance Mary had dreamed of. She didn't know that Percy had money problems. Also, Percy had dishonestly told her that Harriet was unfaithful and that the new baby wasn't his. Now, Godwin, theoretically such a radical, felt very differently when his 16-year-old daughter's future was at stake. He tried to send Percy back to his wife, Harriet. Shelley threatened to kill himself, and he did take an overdose of laudanum, but he was revived. Percy, who had already eloped once, began to plan, but this time he didn't need to bother with an actual marriage. Mary's stepsister Jane aided the couple and insisted on coming with them. They ran off to Dover on July 28, 1814, to take ship for France. They wanted to follow in the footsteps of her mother, Mary Wollstonecraft, who had gone to France to observe the Revolution. Mary Godwin was a terrible sailor, seasick at the best of times, and this was not the best. A thunderstorm with terrific winds struck their small boat and terrified her. So she was sick for the entire journey. This was not a romantic time of running away. They checked into the finest hotel in Calais. Shelley had expensive tastes, though rarely any money. But they were found that very evening by Jane's mother, Mary Jane. She was understandably concerned that her daughter Jane was ruining her reputation by abetting this elopement. Jane refused to return. She stayed with them. Mary Jane left, but she always blamed not Jane herself or Percy Shelley, but Mary Godwin for stealing her daughter. France was a disappointment to the young people. They had little money, and they traveled through lands that had recently been devastated by the Napoleonic Wars. They went on to Switzerland and Germany and finally returned to England in September. By that time, Mary was pregnant. Godwin did not forgive the couple and refused to see them. Jane had no desire to return to her mother. And at this time, she changed her name to the more romantic, she thought, Claire. Mary was often ill during her pregnancy, and Percy spent more and more time with Claire, who was happy to adore him. We don't know if they were actually lovers, but Mary was right to feel jealousy at his attentions. Shelley's answer was that, of course, they believed in free love, so Mary should have her own liaisons, and he pushed her to become closer to their friend Thomas Hogg. In February, Mary gave birth 8 weeks early to a little girl who lived only 13 days. Mary had a dream about bringing her baby's corpse to life, which prefigures Frankenstein. Percy's grandfather had died a few months before, and he was to spend years negotiating for his inheritance, which his father didn't want to give him. Within a year, Mary had given birth to another child, a son, William. She named him after her father, but her father still refused any contact. Shelley was not yet a famous poet, but Lord Byron was. He had recently returned to London from the continent. He was scandalous in both his personal life and the subjects of his poems. He was called mad, bad, and dangerous to know. Mary's stepsister Claire decided she would win him, that her sister wasn't the only one who could seduce a poet. She wrote him, made clear her admiration and her free state as someone not bound by a parent's rules. Byron wasn't going to refuse this offer, though he soon tired of her and planned to leave for Europe. When he refused to take her, she convinced Mary and Percy to travel and meet him there. So this is how they came to be at Lake Geneva. Byron was a romantic wanderer in spirit, but in real life he traveled with numerous carriages, his own bed, dishes, servants, and a menagerie of 8 enormous dogs, 3 monkeys, 5 cats, an eagle, a crow, and a falcon. It was during this stay that the young people, kept indoors by days of rain, read ghost stories. They also were very interested in scientific discoveries of the day, such as galvanism, which was the use of electricity. Well, Mary said she saw a vision of this scene in a sort of waking dream where a scientist is kneeling beside a hideous creature. And in fact, when she wrote up the story, that's the first scene. It starts immediately when the monster comes to life. The long framing story and build-up to the creation that is in the book now were all added later, largely at Percy's direction. She doesn't really explain how this works, except to invoke the ideas of galvanism. The book ended up being extended by both Mary and Percy and was published 2 years later, so that was 200 years ago. Meanwhile, Claire discovered she was pregnant by Byron, but he refused to take any responsibility, and he claimed the baby could be Shelley's. So Mary and Percy, the sister Claire and little William, returned to England to face a tragic autumn. In October, Mary's sister Fanny, that was Mary Wollstonecraft's daughter, who was 3 years older, killed herself by overdose. And in December, Percy's very pregnant wife, Harriet, jumped off a bridge and drowned in the Thames. The positive side to this was that Percy and Mary could now marry, which they did. Just like William Godwin and Mary Wollstonecraft before them, they explained to their friends that this was just for convenience, not an endorsement of marriage as an institution. They had no celebration of this, they just got the legal formalities. But once it was done, William Godwin welcomed his daughter back. He also hoped to get money from Percy. In 1817, Mary gave birth to a daughter, Clara Everina. And in 1818, she produced her other progeny, as she called it. That was the finished manuscript of Frankenstein. It was published anonymously, as a woman couldn't publish such a book under her own name. It received angry reviews, condemning its author as an atheist. How dare someone write about creating life, which is the prerogative of God? But the fact that this was condemned as scandalous, just like now, drove it to become a great seller. A common belief was that Percy Shelley was the author because he wrote a preface, and these godless views matched the public perception of him. The family of Mary, Percy, the children William and Clara, sister Claire and her daughter by Byron Alba, decided to travel to Italy for several reasons. Percy had health issues, which he thought would improve there. He was a bit of a hypochondriac. Mary hoped that Byron would acknowledge Alba, and Claire hoped that she would win Byron back. Byron refused to see Claire, but now he demanded his daughter, even though he was still living an orgiastic life. Percy and Mary got entangled in this soap opera, which resulted in Mary needing to travel across Italy with her daughter Clara, who was ill and subsequently died. The fate of little Alba Byron wasn't any better. She was sent to a convent where she died of illness a few years later. So Byron didn't really want her. Once he got her, he shipped her off. And the following summer in 1819, Mary and Percy's other child, little William, died of malaria. So Mary, at age 22, had borne 3 children and had none living. She withdrew, understandably depressed and upset, leaving Percy again with Claire and other women for long hours. Within 5 months, Mary had a new son, Percy Florence, named after the town of his nativity. But her husband, Percy, had meanwhile developed close friendships with several women in their literary circle. In the summer of 1822, the Shelleys and some of their friends were living on the Gulf of Spezia, west of Pisa. Shelley, Byron, and several authors became enamored of sailing, and they passed many hours planning adaptations to increase the speed of their boats. Mary, 3 months pregnant again, began to bleed uncontrollably, miscarried, and was only saved by Percy's idea of packing her in a tub of cold water and ice. But 2 weeks later, Percy and a friend set sail in a storm on his souped-up boat. So Phoenix, this is like you, these were some young guys in their 20s, souped up their boats to see who could be the fastest and race. It didn't matter that the weather wasn't perfect. They never returned. The modifications he had made to the sailboat only caused problems in difficult weather. Their bodies were found 10 days later. So Mary, at 24 years old, was a widow. She and her son, Percy, moved back to England, where she continued to write her own novels, as well as taking on the task of editing and publishing Shelley's unpublished works. This put her at odds with Shelley's father, who refused to give her more than a token allowance unless she gave up any rights to Shelley's property. Mary hoped that Byron would help her financially, but he was killed the next year fighting in Greece. Ironically, Mary was working on a novel called The Last Man about a sole survivor after a plague on Earth. With Byron's death, she declared that she herself was the last man of their company. But as with Percy's wife, Harriet, a death again helped Mary. Harriet's son, Charles, by Percy, who was a teenager, died. This put young Percy in line as the direct heir and gave them some income. Mary wrote several more novels, none of which had any lasting success. She also wrote a number of chapters in a series called Lives of Eminent Literary Men. She was always close to her one son, Percy. She discouraged several young ladies who wanted to marry him until they found the right one, a woman named Jane St. John, who turned out to be devoted to both the son and the mother. Mary died of a brain tumor at age 53. I'd like to say something about the legacies of both Marys, Wollstonecraft and Shelley. I've seen this issue over and over for the women that I've studied in the 18th and 19th century, like Margaret Fuller, Julia Ward Howe, Clara Barton, Louisa May Alcott. After they died, their friends and family in the Victorian era prettied them up. They emphasized their feminine traits as wives, helpers of great men, role models for children. They removed or downplayed the more radical side, such as their calls for women's suffrage, equal education, and equal pay, or their attempts to live and support themselves. For Mary Shelley, she was long dismissed as Percy's wife, and it was assumed that most of Frankenstein was written by him. However, we have the original manuscript as well as her journals and letters, so there's no question that she wrote the book and they both edited and expanded it. For Mary Wollstonecraft, Godwin wrote a memoir shortly after she died. He wanted to celebrate the personal and passionate side of his wife, so his memoir played up her romantic attachments, which were quite scandalous. She had had several lovers. Readers found that shocking and condemned her, and he gave short shrift to her ideological and philosophical brilliance. It was really only in the 20th century that she began to get her due. Now, I'll just briefly mention some myths about Frankenstein. The first one you probably all know, that the people think the monster's name is Frankenstein, but of course that's the name of the scientist. The monster never has a name, which in itself means something. It shows his isolation and separation. People think the creator was Dr. Frankenstein. Actually, he's never given the title of doctor, although he studies anatomy and other sciences. One belief is that the monster is naturally evil and cruel. In Mary's telling, the monster starts as nothing, that blank slate that Rousseau described. He tries to follow his creator, but he's rejected. Out in the world, at first he only perceives cold and hunger and other direct feelings. In an unlikely section of the book, he lives outside a cottage for months, observing a happy family within and learning culture, language, and even reading from them. This part of the book, as someone who studied languages, I thought, this is not believable. And I thought, oh, I already accepted that this monster could come to life. Now I'm questioning his learning methods. But he finally tries to speak to one of them, and of course he's rebuffed with terror, and he becomes angry because he's rejected. Now another view is that the monster is gentle and only harms people by accident, but in the story, because he gets angry at his bad parent, he wants revenge, and he's further embittered when Frankenstein refuses to create a mate for him to ease his terrible loneliness. When the monster meets a child who is a relative of Frankenstein, he kills him deliberately, and he kills Frankenstein's wife on their wedding night. Another thing you might think from the movie is that the monster doesn't speak or barely speaks. In Mary's book, when the monster meets his creator, he discourses in flowery sentences for pages on pages with allusions to the Bible and Paradise Lost. He sees himself as both Adam, a created man rejected from the garden, and Lucifer, the rebellious angel. And these were themes that Byron also had in his poetry and Shelley. So supposedly the monster learned all this from this trunk of books that he found. And then you might remember think that the monster was killed by villagers with torches, but in most of the book, the monster is isolated in northern climates and very few people see him. At the end, his creator dies from the hardships of the chase and the monster is last seen running off over the ice floes. So what does Frankenstein say to us today? At the heart is the question about man playing God as such. Because we can do a thing, should we do it? We can adjust DNA in the womb to cure a disease, but will we next want to adjust it for eye color or other traits? Atomic energy seemed a great boon, but there's a problem of nuclear waste, and not to mention the horrific possibility of destruction of the planet. Or even something benign like plastic. We now know that not only does plastic clog the earth and the sea for millennia, but it's now found in earth, water, animals, and us. While looking for books on Mary Shelley, I found one called Bioethics in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. One contributor wrote that Frankenstein shows that Shelley understood the scientific principles of her time. Another wrote that Frankenstein shows that Mary Shelley didn't know the first thing about actual scientific procedure. But there is one whole section about contemporary issues in bioethics, and I'll just tell you some of the titles. Transplant surgeons must determine when an organ donor is truly dead. The sale of body parts should be legalized. Stem cell research poses difficult issues. Genetic testing forces parents to make difficult decisions. There's also the whole field of artificial intelligence. What happens when computers are now able to learn, teach themselves more quickly than we can even teach them? And of course, we see the use of Frankenstein's name in the labeling of genetically modified plants as Frankenfoods. Well, Mary Shelley didn't totally come down on one side or the other in the debate. Clearly, it was a mistake for Frankenstein to try to create life. And you could take the feminist tack that it's not so much about replacing God as replacing woman. He created life without a woman. Because he could have created life by getting married. But when we reject legitimate scientific discoveries such as vaccination, then we're playing God in a different way. I know a woman in her 40s who's been losing her eyesight since birth due to a genetic condition. She can perceive only some light. She recently found out that she qualifies for gene repair that could theoretically turn her sight back on. Well, who would want to deny her that? And yet, we can imagine less benign uses for genetic manipulation. So some of you may know much more about the fields of science than I do.
Thank you, Robin.
For the closing words, I have two contradictory quotations from Frankenstein. How dangerous is the acquirement of knowledge, and how much happier that man is who believes his native town to be the world than he who aspires to be greater than his nature would allow. But she also said, with how many things are we on the brink of becoming acquainted if cowardice or carelessness did not restrain our inquiries? So join us for coffee and further discussion.